Hello everyone and welcome to The Hidden Lives of Writers. My name's Fiona Snickers and I'm joined by my co-host Gail Schimmel.
Hi Fiona.
Gail, how has your writing week been? What's happening?
Fiona, it's exciting. So first of all, thank you. Mm-hmm. I took your advice and I wrote on the aeroplane.
How did that go?
It worked very well. I managed to shrug off my conviction that I always have that the person sitting next to me is reading over my shoulder and judging me. I got over that mm-hmm. and I managed to write on the plane. And it's interesting, I'm involved in a group project that's a very experimental project. So you may hear me talking about it for ages and then it never going anywhere, or maybe not. But the thing about a group project is you have to deliver. If it's your turn and there's a deadline and there is a group of people waiting for you to deliver on your deadline, you don't have a choice. If you're a person like me, you don't have a choice. A deadline is a deadline. A commitment is a commitment.
Yeah.
And so that has been the thing that has shown me that actually when you have to do it, you will find the time to do it and you will get over the man sitting next to you on the aeroplane and you will write your words. And hopefully I will take that forward. And I'm having a lot of fun with that project. So, you know, it's still there. The magic's still in me somewhere.
Oh, I'm so glad to hear that.
And what about you, Fiona?
Well, I guess this is also a group project, but film writing has come back into my life. And I thought I had taken this film project as far as I could and contributed as much as I could. And it was now time to step back. And I tried to step back. And the response was, no, not quite yet. Let's give this another bash and see if we can get it into a better shape or form. And the feedback I'm getting from everybody who has ever done this before is, do not despair. There's nothing wrong with you. These things go through multiple drafts, and many of them have to have page one revisions where you just redraft the thing from the very beginning, reconceptualize it completely. And it was getting so exhausting for me that I couldn't quite see myself doing it again. And now I've been told that the problems are structural. It needs to be restructured, not completely rewritten. And I guess I can do that, especially with a bit of mentoring and help. So I've got some Zoom sessions lined up. I'm going to hopefully get the help I need and then be able to put this redraft onto paper.
And are you not feeling fed up with that story and fed up with that process and like bored?
Yes, that's also a big problem for me. And I think with screenplay writing, you can't get bored, you can't get sick of it because they do go through so many drafts. And as a novelist, I would not still be tinkering and reworking and still be in that same world. I just wouldn't be able to handle it. But if I am going to do any screenplay writing, which is by no means clear, then I'm going to have a bit more patience and a bit more willingness to sit in discomfort for a while.
And outside your comfort zone, how have you been finding comfort in what you've read and listened to and watched?
Well, I've actually been reading an uncomfortable book lately.
Oh, no.
It's called My Nemesis by Charmaine Craig. And it's interesting to think of it as a kind of companion piece to Yellowface because it's an Asian woman writer writing in the character of a white woman who is observing an Asian woman. So it's very much the Yellowface thing, but it's more personal. My nemesis is the Asian woman who's being observed by the white woman character. And it's not at all clear really who the nemesis is. The white woman thinks the Asian woman is her nemesis, but really the extremely scary character is the white woman who's doing the observing and kind of imposing all these things on the Asian woman character that we have no reason to think are actually there. So it's a very, very she said, and she said kind of book. It's fascinating. It's literary. It raises all kinds of interesting questions. And from me, it's a high recommend.
Interesting. And we know how much you loved Yellowface.
I did indeed. And what have you been busy with?
Well, also speaking of things that you love, Gabrielle Zevin,
Zevin,
the author of Tomorrow, Tomorrow, and Tomorrow. And I have just read, which I think is one of her earliest works, possibly even her debut, The Storied Life of A.J. Fikry.
Yes.
And it's just a lovely, lovely book. It's the story of a bookseller who lives on an island, and it's really the story of part of his life. And it starts each chapter with a thing that he's writing. I'm not going to spoil anything. So a thing that he's writing to another character about short stories.
Mm-hmm.
And I listen to a lot of short stories on podcasts. And I had this amazing moment where a short story that I'd listened to on a pod that had felt like quite an intimate experience between me and the short story. Like it felt like something nobody else had been part of.
Mm-hmm.
And then he wrote one of the little bits he writes about a short story was about that short story.
Mm-hmm.
And I was like, oh, other people have heard that short story or read that short story. And it was bizarre how until that moment it had been such a private experience. But the book is lovely and charming and sad and just high recommend as well.
I enjoyed that book. I really did. I think it was a remarkable debut. And an author who has written in the short story space and multiple novels, a very, very prolific writer and multi-award winning, is our guest today. Our guest today is Ntikeng Mohlele. Ntikeng is the author of 6 novels, among them The Scent of Bliss, Small Things, Rusty Bell, Pleasure, Michael Kay, Breasts, etc., as well as short story collections, The Discovery of Love, and A Little Light. Ntikeng has won several awards for his writing, including the University of Joburg Prize, the K. Sello Dacre Memorial Award, and he was longlisted for the International Dublin Literary Award. Ntikeng, thank you for your time and welcome.
Thank you very much for the invitation. I'm glad to be here.
Ntikeng, tell us, how has your writing week been?
I have not been writing at all.
It's such a comfort to me how many people are saying that recently.
I've run away from my writing desk because I've got a new project out. And, the book was quite a daunting project. So I'm taking a well-deserved rest, I believe.
And when you are writing and writing well, what does your day look like?
I am a typical writer in such that I don't keep schedules at all. And I don't have routines of any kind whatsoever. I write when I feel like I should be writing. And I would feel that wave of inspiration and literature forming in my head. And
how often does that happen? Every day, once a week?
If I'm working on a project, it's quite frequent. But if I need to put a week or 20 days in between, I do that. But I would never forget where I was.
Really?
No.
You don't have to go back and reread?
No, I don't have to do that.
I'm fascinated by this. Sorry, Fiona, I'm going to hog the questions now. I'm fascinated.
Yeah.
And you feel no guilt about being away from it?
No. I don't relate to literature as words only. Literature happens to me musically and on a color palette. So the relationship I have with words is primarily musical, actually. So it's like a tune. You know, if you pause a tune, if you know a melody, you know it. You know, it doesn't matter if it's here in the 1800s or 1652 or 2004. It's a melody that's in tune with you as a person and what your thoughts are, your aspirations are for a story and for characters. So I don't keep schedules at all. And I don't work on a computer at all.
What do you work on?
I work on my phone, on my iPhone.
I want to talk because you're making me think about synesthesia, which is the condition where people experience their senses in different ways. For example, they might say that they hear colors or they smell sounds or something like that. And it's so interesting to me that you experience literature as music. And I'm wondering if that is a form of synesthesia.
I wouldn't want to lie. I've got absolutely no idea, and I've never really questioned it in any way, shape or form. I've just, you know, accepted it for what it is.
Has it always been this way for you?
It's even in memory, that's how it, like if I needed to remember a particular time when I was really little, it's very vivid. You know, and people that know me from when I was a child get very shocked how I could remember things that, you know, a child is not expected to remember. And when I say remember, I mean remember at a sensory level. If it was a meal, I would know exactly what it was. I would know...
Oh, my God, I can't even remember what I had for breakfast today.
Who was present there, what the temperature was like on that day, what I was feeling, any anxieties, any happiness, any doubt of anything would be quite clear. So when I work with characters, as I create them, I get to know them quite intimately. Beyond the page, like know them really, really, really well.
So you have a sense of your character, you have a big background story going on that doesn't make it into the page.
I know what underpants are there.
We could ask you what's your character's favourite colour and you know.
I would know. It doesn't mean that everything has to necessarily be on the page, but I think one has to understand and know the character well enough to be able to withhold what needs to be withheld.
And would I be right in saying you don't need to have thought about it before, but you will just know when we ask the question? So if we say, what's your character's favorite food, you might not have thought about it before, but you'll know the answer.
In most cases, yes. 9 out of 10.
Wow, that is so interesting. I was actually going to ask later on about the role of music in your stories, because it seems to play a very big role. And I was going to ask you about your personal connection to music, whether you are a musician or a singer, or whether you just experience the world musically, because music appears so often in your narratives.
Maybe this might sound like a cheesy answer, but it's true. I'm black, and being a man of color, like the euphemistically refer to it, culturally music is everything to black people anywhere in the world. Actually, it doesn't matter what continent, what country, whether on the African continent or in the diaspora, music is a very important cultural anchor and a spiritual mode of existence, so to speak. So that happens whether it's in praise poetry, whether it's in idiomatic speech, whether it's in nursery rhymes, etc., etc. Being a black person, music is with you from birth, quite literally. And that is why you've got a lot of black musicians that have never seen a music school in their life. You give them an instrument, self-taught, they just know it, where to take it. Musically. And that goes for choral music, that goes for formal musical genres and art forms. So from that point of view, to answer you, Fiona, if I was not a writer, I would most likely 100% be a musician. No doubt about that.
So do you see music as a way of telling stories in the same way as words on the page are a way of telling stories?
Yes, correct. Because music is emotive and it's mysterious and it's sensory for me as a person. And it can evoke all sorts of atmospheric details. It can create all manner of longing, celebratory feelings, etc., etc. And music by itself connects you to yourself, so to speak. You know, when you are younger, you get a very limited range of music you can listen to, because as a young person, you don't have literally money to create your own collection. So you'd start with normal local music, but my palette has expanded over the years. That I wanted to, as best as I can, to be knowledgeable as within reason as much as possible, whether it's in jazz, whether it's calypso music, whether it's indigenous African songs, whether it's rock and roll. whether it's punk rock, whether it's hard rock, the Mozarts and the Pushkins and the Vivaldis of the world, the Mendelssohns, and, you know, you name them.
What a different, you're giving us viewpoints we've never heard on this podcast before. You touched briefly indirectly on your background, and I wanted to ask you about that. From what I've read on the internet, which is not always accurate, your background is rural Limpopo and then townshipy childhood. And I wanted to talk to you about how does a writer grow from that? Because it is, you know, often I think that being able to, knowing that one can be a writer is a privileged thing to know, to even know that that's one of the options. So can you tell us about your childhood and how it grew you into being a writer?
It's growing in an environment. I grew up in the mid, you know, like I'm born in 77. So that trajectory from 77 to the 85 state of emergency. So all that turmoil, political turmoil I've seen as a child. I mean, I grew up with army caspers in the township and tear gas smoke and, you know, government property being set on fire and all of that. And there's a strange detachment in a child's mind to sort of understand all of that, that what's going on. And you see all manner of brutalities and all manner of injustices as a child. But being an introverted child, you don't have the register or the vocabulary to actually explain all of that. But it does actually impact you on a subconscious level, growing up like that. And seeing violence in society. The crime that we see now, a lot of people think, there's crime now. I hold a different view. I might be wrong. But that sort of violence has always been there. It's just been bottled up in the townships. Stabbings, frustrations, alcoholism, etc., etc. But now that you've got a democratized society, spills all over in areas, including now in the suburbs. Which is most unfortunate, because it's an unequal society then, it's an unequal society now. So that formative thing is the ability, is two factors. One is sensory observation of things that you're not intellectually equipped to explain yet. That is number one. Number two is being an introverted person. You know, I am an introverted person, so I observe a lot of things around me. And the good platform, it's literature, to be able to actually make sense of those things, reflect on them, and record them from an artistic point of view. And then my studies was dramatic arts, because I was drawn very much to motion pictures before I was really drawn to novels. So my undergraduate degree is in dramatic arts, in performance arts. Then I moved to study African literatures, which now included American literature, Caribbean literature, etc., etc. So English literature, etc. So, and from that point of view, naturally then I gravitated to actually writing my own stories, so to speak, yeah.
It's interesting to me how we as South African writers have evolved to write about the apartheid days. Mm-hmm. There was a time, you know, when liberation was new and the TRC was happening, when the literature seemed very focused on reflecting on the apartheid days. Mm-hmm. And then at the time when I was coming up as a writer, we were diversifying into genres and starting to look in different directions, to look at stories that weren't connected to the past. Mm-hmm. There was a kind of sense that maybe we were putting that all behind us. Mm-hmm. And now I think we're entering a period of reflection again. Mm-hmm. And I've noticed, you know, although your primary themes are very much around relationships and sensuality, you do also reflect on apartheid and what it did to us as a nation. Is it an ongoing preoccupation of yours, or do you feel as though that's something that you are finished with now?
It's a dicey, slippery question for many reasons, key among which is where do you draw the line? You know, it would be, I think, a quote-unquote betrayal of people that have gone through a lot in the evolution of South African society, and with the bigger backdrop, colonial Africa, so to speak, because these horrors were not here, only here in South Africa. If you look at German South West Africa with the Germans there, and you look at the Congo, the Belgian Congo,
just thinking that
It's atrocious, the things that happened there, but it's human horrors. Because if you go to Mississippi and the transatlantic slave trade, and what gave us the Americas as we have them, you know, and you look at British colonialism, almost in a big percentage of the world, including in India. You look at the evolution of the Caribbean, for example, Spanish conquest. It's a much more complex question to say, where do you draw the line? The flip side of that would be if you look at Jewish history, for example, with the Holocaust. Human beings are very fascinating creatures, but they can be also downright evil.
So when these things occur, we can never stop looking at them. They will always draw our attention as writers.
And unfortunately, I think because they shape so much of human relations in a particular time period and a geographical locality.
Mm-hmm.
And whether we like it or not, there is just that unfortunate residue, in my view, that remains in how people relate. And they create all sorts of distrust and disillusion and, you know, misapprehension because there is, whether we like it or not, collective damage on different phases and different levels and intensities. And as if we assume that the premise that art reflects life, then it's not something that you can really completely divorce. I don't think it should necessarily be an obsession, because if it's an obsession, then it presupposes that apartheid, colonialism, slave trade were so important over and above what normal living should be.
Mm. You mentioned the way that the genders relate to each other and the power struggles implicit in that. And many of your stories do involve a male character reflecting on his libidinous attraction to female characters, which introduces the implication of the male gaze, which is a patriarchal institution in its nature. But you also have some very well-rounded and very well-developed female characters in your novel. Can you tell us how you sort of walk that tightrope between portraying the male gaze but also giving female characters their full personhood?
It's a very slippery slope. My spine goes cold in working in with those themes, because there is a presumption, I think, that, you know, that thematic preoccupation is new. There's nothing new about it, in my view. Even in biblical time, if you read the Bible, there's nothing that is anywhere in my work that you can't find in the Bible. Is there? Madame Bovary, Lolita.
You mentioned Philip Roth.
Roth, Devil on the Cross, Soyinka, Maria Maba, So Long a Letter, Nervous Conditions. All those themes have been there before I began working as a writer. And not only in literature, it's there in music. There's one of my favorite songs, You Shook Me All Night Long by AC/DC. Great track. But if you were to look at it from just a critical, analytical point of view, you would say it's a misogynist song. If you look at hip-hop as a movement, very misogynist in lyrical content and just posturing between the genders, so to speak, and power relations in corporates, in government, in politics, and what have you. There remains that tension between feminist movement and society being resistant towards change. So for me, it becomes interesting and suicidal, artistically speaking, to explore those areas, which assumes that ladies are not sensual and sexual beings, which I think is hogwash. If they were not, there would be no people in the world, would there?
I'm going to bring us back very much to writing process, because that's my obsession. Mm-hmm. You've written long novels and short stories. Your newest book is a collection of short stories, if I'm correct. And I'm interested in an idea comes to you. How do you know immediately this is a long-form work or this is a short work? How much do you know when you start writing about what the form is? And also, how much do you know about the story when you start writing?
I don't know anything about the story before I start writing. I prefer not to know anything about the story before I get writing, or what form it would be, what length it would be, which character is going to go where and achieve what ends. I prefer not to know about that. But the moment I begin working on it, I commit to the different details. And I work in a time continuum. I can decide for a story to say, when this story ends, this guy is in jail. Then I have to find out what he has done to get there.
Okay.
And work backwards. Sometimes I start smack in the middle. This person has got a crisis. How much of a crisis do I want to make it? Is it external? Is it internal? Then I work from there. So each story is got its own treatment, but I don't necessarily prefer to know. Plotting a story to say this area, no, I don't work like that. It's more like a conscious improvisation in how I work. And it happens very much in jazz, where they would have a framework to say this is a framework of the song, the fundamentals of the song. But everyone can, contribute to that, whether it's vocals or a solo in that song. But everyone else is listening to what the fundamental framework of the song is. And the band leader would, at the end, bring everyone together, whether through a melody or just winding down a song. My guide light is that I try my best that what I put down is quality.
You've given me one other question. Do you read your work aloud in the editing process, because sound is obviously very important to you? Do you check the music of your work by reading it aloud?
No, I do not.
Do you hear it in your head?
I hear it in my head, and it might be strange, but it's important and it's true that I'll state it. Almost everything that I've written to date is first draft.
Really?
I've never had more than two drafts in a thing. I make sure that what I put down is what must be put down, so that I don't go back and waste time cutting and readjusting. And so I try to make sure that what I set down is what needs to be set down. And I trust it first time that I put it on the page. Because I'm naturally an introverted and cerebral person, I think, there's a lot of reflection before I choose what goes onto a page. Not necessarily the story, but where the emphasis is going to be. So the story would unfold because of just that creative energy that comes to bear.
Have you ever had an editor tell you, oh, this needs to be redrafted, and where you've disagreed with that editor? And if so, whose view would prevail? Have you ever had that kind of conflict?
Fortunately not. You know, a mentor of mine, Professor Khositsile, Kurapetse Khositsile, gave me one of the most important literary creation notes ever. That saved me a lot of time and guided my writing immensely. And I'm forever indebted to him. I remember exactly where we were. We were at the Museum Africa. I had gifted him a copy of The Scent of Bliss, which was my debut novel at the time. I remember the cover was, the gift wrap was brown. It had gold streaks on it. I remember it very, very well. Overcast morning, I gave him this book. And then he says to me, we're looking at Mary Fitzgerald Square and then on Bree Street. Then he says, you know, when you write, you must write in such a way that no one, no editor, no other writer or anyone can alter the meaning, even the smallest punctuation, without changing your original intent. And that was profound.
Wow. Our late poet laureate.
Yes. So I'm forever grateful to him. So when I compose a sentence, I make sure that it's airtight. So yes, you can tweak it here and there, but it doesn't give you much room to cross out sections or even phrases of it. And I work very, very well with my editor, Sean Fraser. He's an amazing editor, you know. So, and if he says these three lines need to move to this area or we don't need them, this is my reason. I trust him because I know he's an experienced editor and he takes his work very seriously. So for that reason, it's also I think that writers need to be flexible. Being particular in your creative approach does not mean you should be inflexible, because you cannot always be right as a human being. Sometimes you might feel strongly about something and you might be hopelessly wrong about it. So it helps to check the ego at the door and focus on the artwork as the most critical and important thing that you need to defer to make sure that it's worth the reader's time at the end of the day.
Let's talk about Michael Kay.
Yes, let's.
So you took, I think you were one of the first writers to take a character of J.M. Coetzee and take it further into your own novel. What motivated you to do that? Were you just trying to take the story further or develop the potential of the character further? Were you trying to criticize what Coetzee had done? And how was the process? Did he ever respond in any way?
Let me answer from the end. He didn't respond in any way. It was a suicide mission, quote unquote. Only a artistically suicidal person would take such a... and accomplish artistic artwork and do what I did with it. But I think that I am a great fan of intertextuality within reason and conversation between texts and artistic periods, you know. And for that reason, I thought that it would be a wonderful creative challenge, because Life and Times of Michael Kay is one of my favorite texts. And I didn't want it to end there. I thought that I would give myself a great artistic challenge to write, quote-unquote, a sequel to it, which was quite a serious undertaking, and the risks involved far outweighed what could be done with it. That's the whole purpose of art. It's that cross-pollination. It's important. And to not have written it would have been a waste of artistic time, an artistic time window, so to speak.
I want to get back to the male characters reflecting on their sexuality. You often adopt a kind of humorous, mock-serious tone. Is it for you in the nature of sexuality? Is sexuality in its nature absurd, or is it just your way of looking at it that keeps slipping into a humorous tone?
I think it's both. I think sexuality, for me, operates on different levels. One, there's the sensual, for me. There's the gaze that is sexual. There's the erotic without necessarily being physical, in my view. And there is the misapprehensions that come with sexuality. Because sexuality, I think it's a story in itself. And I've been criticized that, there's a reviewer I read that, you know, my characters sexually are bloodless. And I mused at that comment because I am not a pornographer. I'm a literary fiction writer. So I need to check those boundaries whenever I write. And I think to pick on Fiona's note, yes, it is a bird's eye view, because I don't necessarily believe in getting my hands too dirty into the graphic details of sexual representation and reflection in literature.
Interesting. You've won a lot of prizes. You've been shortlisted for things. You've been critically acclaimed. Does it put a different sort of pressure on your writing?
No, not at all. Because I don't do it for awards and for prizes and being... Those are nice. There's flattery that comes with all of that. I think it would be disingenuous to pretend that it's not nice for your peers or your industry to recognize the work that you do. But it's not the end all for me. You know, if I wrote a book that was, to my mind... representative of what I needed to create with a particular project, and it didn't win anything, it wouldn't bother me.
If it didn't win any, what about if it didn't get published? Do you need the reader?
Yes, you do need the reader, because I don't... Solitary as writing is, writing only grows when there are eyeballs on pages, so to speak, yeah.
Interesting.
Plot is not king in your books. Your books are not primarily plot-driven. There is a plot, but much more foregrounded is the reflections of a particular character on a particular subject, and they often veer into philosophy and psychology and history. Has it always been that way for you? Do you think more in terms of reflective thought than in being driven by plot? Is there any tension in it for you? How does that work for you?
I'm not a slave of plot, let me put it that way, even though it's important, because the material needs to be coherent at the end of the day. But it's the latter, more on philosophical reflection on any thematic preoccupation at a given time. And for that reason, I am more drawn to, philosophical writing and literary writers that actually delve into the inner core and the inner membrane of any subject matter that they choose. I am impatient with, you know, peripheral, too light-hearted, go nowhere kind of writing. It has to teach me something at a cerebral level, at a sensory level, at a human spirit level. And you can only get that if you actually delve into what human psychology is. And human psychology cannot be restricted to plot, so to speak. And it goes back to music, that with each composition, for instance, there would be a standard original track, then there would be covers of that song. And the covers would be different, sometimes better than the original.
Strange enough, on the way here, I was listening to a podcast with the English writer David Nichols, who seems to have a playlist for a lot of his books, that when they bring the book out, they also bring a playlist out. And it sounds to me like this is something you should be doing. Good, you're writing it down. It sounds to me like something that would really appeal to you. Would I be right?
You'd be absolutely right. For one of the biggest reasons would be precisely that we forget that stories actually happen in a time continuum, and how that plot is actually another expression of time. It's the sequencing of events. And there's grand time, there's personal time, there's subconscious time. It happens in violence, in dreams, in social interaction, etc. Each time stamp has got its different character. So what plot is for me is the variation and the tonalities of the different time types, so to speak, that represent human activity and progress at any sociocultural milieu. That's what a plot is. It's not some stuck-up brick somewhere to say, when you write literature, this is whatever. That my understanding of it is those time in grand scale, time in minutiae. On a personal level, how human beings relate to the universe, to animals, to nature, to plants, to other human beings, to aggressors, to seducers, to would-be seducers, to the seduced, to the out of reach. That is what a plot is. For
play,
me, personally. Yeah.
Place also seems to be important in your work. Sometimes a city almost seems like an additional character in your novels. And historically, Sophia Town has a kind of gravitational pull, particularly over black writers in South Africa. Now, you're not of the age to have lived through that period, but I can see that you're drawn to it and interested in it. Is it something that holds a particular fascination for you, both place in general and Sophia Town in particular?
Yes, indeed, it does. And I've actually put Sophia Town front and center in Small Things for many reasons, one of which is music. Because music, I'm a great fan of music of the 50s from that period. Because the music that we have now evolved in many ways from musical bands of the period of Sophia Town. The second thing is political resistance around Group Areas Act and the movement of forced movement of people to Meadowlands, leaving Sophia Town being renamed Triumph at that time. But also there was a lot of intellectual engagement and reflections through writers like Ken Temba and the drum era, so to speak. So it's a very important cross-pollination with the big band and swing era in the United States, for example, around the jazz thing and the mushrooming and growth of jazz bands and artists and of that particular period. So, and also in theatrical expression of living conditions of the period. So Fiona is absolutely right. Place is very, very important for me, and the cosmopolitan, I've got the natural predisposition to cosmopolitan settings, because it's a melting pot of so many things. And I'm fortunate that the foundations of my personhood combine rural settings where my culture is very strong, where the culture is not a reference thing in the library, it's a lived experience.
I've got quite an unusual question, and I think it's to do with how you're talking about music and writing together. My father was a fine artist. He was a painter. And I'm wondering, is that an aspect of art and artistic expression you've ever looked at? Painting, drawing, is that something that's of interest to you or not really?
It is of great interest to me. And not only visual arts, as in like paintings. You know, you'd have your Rembrandt and you'd have your Da Vinci's and, you know, like famous painters. You'd have your Gerald Scotto's, Sophia Town, as well, in terms of just taking facets of human existence and putting them in a gallery. And that is a social interaction thing. And again, it comes back to plot, because if you look at a painting, there is plot there. Color, light, texture, and a reference to a particular subject matter. And I had to tell a white lie to my daughter. My daughter is 8. Her name is Naledi. So she likes making drawings for me. And I had said, you know, you must draw the Mona Lisa for me. And she did. And she says, oh, Papa, I said, it's the best Mona Lisa I've ever seen. Even Da Vinci has nothing on you. At that age, she's very, very, very artistic, you know. So visual arts, I am fascinated by. Whether it's oil on canvas, whether it's pencil drawings, I really, really love them. And most importantly, also documentary photography and documentary film, for that matter. So artistically, I try to learn as much as I can. I don't know everything, but I open myself to learn new things. For example, the lead character in Breast Etc. is a portrait photographer, and I was unaware of how much I had accumulated in my appreciation of the photographic discipline until I created that character. And it was just fascinating. And that happened from muscle memory. I didn't have to refer anything, really.
I'm remembering that you said at the beginning that your stories come to you in the form of music and also a color palette.
Yes.
That visual angle was there.
Yes.
So speaking of consuming culture in its various forms, what have you been reading or listening to or watching lately that's made an impression on you?
For some reason, something has happened in terms of switching off from television and motion pictures, which is unlike me. But I think I've watched too many of these things that I think I need a time gap to reorientate my campus, artistic campus. But I've written down here, I'm rereading Crime and Punishment.
Mm-hmm.
I think for the maybe fourth time now, and every time I read it, I see many things that I partially understood or completely missed. I'm rereading Boyhood, JMC, and then one of my favorite writers is Bello, so I'm reading Herzog in small portions. I like Seize the Day, the Adventures of Augimat, but I think that his most accomplished book for me personally is Herzog. So I read that because it's very, very, very humorous. It's very intelligent in how it is written. And I enjoy the poetry of Soyinka because it's difficult, quote-unquote difficult, but because I know it comes from a great mind. So it's like putting together for me a mathematical puzzle in challenging myself to decipher the poetry of Wole Soyinka. And I enjoy also reading a lot of literary criticism from, you know, like your leading literary journals and newspaper, the New York Times and the London Review of Books, for example. Because it just positions for me where the world is going in terms of social thought. And social thought is not necessarily all embedded in literature. At some point, there's that magnetic gravitational pull between the two. And a writer is in a very privileged position in terms of being able to cherry pick the themes that a writer at a particular social, socio-cultural, economic milieu is able to magnify or cast light on that particular theme, so to speak, yeah.
Well, Ntikeng, we hope that everyone checks out your full backlist of work because it rewards scrutiny. And we are so happy to have had you in the studio to talk to us. So thank you for your time.
Thank you very much, ladies. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much.
It's a great pleasure to be here to talk about books. So I'm like a pig in mud, you know. So, yeah.
Gail, I have to ask if you are okay because you became quite emotional talking to
Ntikeng. It was extraordinary. I've never had a reaction like that to an interview before, and even for my father. There was a very strong relationship between music and art and music and everything. And my father was obsessed with Sophiatown and my father was obsessed with jazz. And it was just a perfect storm of weird coincidences. And then when he started talking about poetry and maths, mm-hmm. my father was very interested in poetry and maths and the overlap between the two. So yeah, a particularly emotional interview for me, and unexpectedly so. I didn't see that coming. What about you? What did you take from it?
Well, I was so interested in what he said about only writing when he feels moved to write. That is so unusual, you know.
So.
He's such a prolific writer. He told us off mic that he's got two more books locked and loaded in editing now for release in 2024 and 2025. And that's just remarkable. And he only writes when he feels moved to write and will sometimes take, you know, a three-week break from his project.
And here we are writing according to plans and trying to show up every day, and we don't have three books locked in.
We also have the sense that our way is the right way to do it. And that, you know, you can't wait for inspiration to move you. You just have to sit down and do it.
I mean, we say that a lot, Fiona. We tell people that a lot. There is no muse. The muse is dead. You've got to sit on your bum and write. And King would have us believe otherwise.
He would. And it works for him. It works, in fact, incredibly award-winningly well for him. So I think the lesson here is I've just got to realize I'm not always right, even about stuff that I'm convinced about.
Listen, I do think that he is a rare person. I very much had a sense of speaking to someone much cleverer than myself. I think he is a very clever person, a very talented person, a very unusual person. And I think possibly for 90% of writers, you've got to show up before the muse will show up for you. And then maybe 10% on Ntikeng's who the muse will come to you and do your bidding.
Absolutely. Yeah. He's a unicorn and we can't all operate by the rules of the unicorns. Gail, I've got some exciting news. You know, in our last podcast, we put a call out to listeners to write to us with any writing questions they might have. And we got such a great one from Penny from Fishhook. Thank you so much for DMing us, Penny. And Penny says, "Hi, Gail and Fiona. I'm enjoying listening to the podcast so much, and I have a writing question. What do you do when one of your characters starts behaving in an unpredictable and unruly way? How do you get them back in line, or shouldn't you?"
So this is, I mean, I love it when a character takes off. It does not happen to me that much. It happens a little bit. And I do love that feeling of the character leading me rather than me leading the character. But I have had the experience that Penny's question makes me think of the most is, I think I've said on this pod before that I don't love writing sex. Mm-hmm. And I had some characters who, every time I let them be together in a room, they started having quite vigorous sex. And I didn't like writing it down, but they wanted me to. And I eventually broke them up so that they would stop having vigorous sex everywhere. The whole kind of arc of the story changed because of those two and their insatiable appetites. I had to break them up to make them behave. So that's my most real experience of that. What about you? Does this happen to you a lot, Fiona?
Well, it got me thinking about what Sue Nyati said in a podcast, which is that she started dreaming about a character who was telling her, I don't want to be dead. You have to bring me back to life. I'm not happy to be dead. I've got more things to do. And she did bring that character back to life. She just had her sort of get very ill and then get better instead of the original plan, which was to die. So I think there certainly is space for letting characters do what they want and letting them lead you and guide you. But sometimes you have to break them up and make them stop having sex in the room. you have to whip them back into shape.
At the risk of sounding a bit woo-woo about the writing process, which I am not at all woo-woo about the writing process, but I do sometimes think there's something going on in your subconscious that then when the characters are talking to you and telling you and misbehaving and things like that, sometimes you've worked out a plot thing at the back of your brain that you aren't conscious yet of having worked out, but the characters are going to take you to that thing you've worked out, I think. Does that sound too woo-woo?
No, that sounds very possible. Yes, yes. I see the way plot points pop from the back of my head into the front of my head. And suddenly I go, oh, aha, this needs to happen.
And you find you've actually already written the first clues to that plot point. And you weren't, when you wrote it, you thought you were doing a throwaway thing. And then it turns out that actually it fits completely with the way the book's going to turn out going. And that's the best feeling.
That is a lovely feeling. So I think the answer is let those characters talk to you. Sometimes you listen to them.
Sometimes
you break them up. And you do what suits the story. You do what works well for you. So we are loving these questions. Please keep them coming. You can put them on our social media sites. You can DM us. You can email us. We'd love to hear from you.
You've been listening to another production from Solid Gold Podcasts.